Well, it's a real privilege for me to be here and to be able to be part of this weekend. I just want to make myself available for you, if for people who'd like to talk, share in confidence, anything, that's absolutely fine. And I don't come with a whole lot of slick answers to difficult, challenging problems. If you've come expecting some nice, slick, simple answers to some difficult questions, then I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed, because I haven't got any nice, slick answers. In fact, I don't think there are any simple answers. But I do profoundly believe that in all the messiness and complexity of the modern world, that the Christian faith does provide real ways of thinking and engaging with the issues of the world, and provides a way of not just thinking about things, but of practically responding. And so I hope together, as we think about some of these complex and difficult issues, we can support and encourage one another. And I'm going to be talking a fair amount, but there'll be a chance for Q&A and discussion, so please write down any issues or questions as you go along, and I'd be delighted to, there'll be time for Q&A, particularly this afternoon. So I've worked most of my life as a baby doctor in a big intensive care unit in central London. I went into the field of pediatrics mainly because I love children and because it was a very rapidly advancing kind of medicine and a very challenging area. But as I went into it, I discovered that I was in the midst of a whole ethical maelstrom. As the science was advancing, it was possible to keep babies alive, younger and younger gestational ages. And it's now commonplace for babies to survive at 23 and 24 weeks of gestation out of the normal 40 weeks or 9 months of pregnancy. And as the technology advances, more and more babies are able to survive. In fact, the youngest baby who survived that I ever cared for was 21 weeks and 6 days. And it's a very exciting kind of medicine, very rewarding, and yet it raises all kinds of questions about the cost. It costs somewhere between £1,500 and £2,000 per baby per day. So the total cost of ensuring a premature baby survives could be easily £100,000, all paid for by the NHS, free at the point of need. We invest a lot of money and resources and time and expertise in trying to keep these tiny little babies alive. That's actually my hand and one of the babies on the baby unit, just to give you an idea of scale. It's a very technologically sophisticated kind of medicine, lots of machinery. That's a rather old slide on taken on the neonatal unit. And somewhere in the middle of all that, there's a baby. This is the baby's head, and this is the baby's body. Everything else is the technology that's keeping a tiny baby alive. So we as a society seem to be saying that these lives are precious, that they're worth investing in, that they're valuable. But just one floor away in the same hospital in central London is the fetal medicine unit. And here a large number of pregnant women are referred if an abnormality of some problem in the unborn baby, the fetus, is found. And the sophisticated technology is used, ultrasound scanning like this, amniocentesis, various genetic tests, sometimes fetal MRI scans. And if an abnormality is found, the mother will be offered an abortion. And because of the way that the law works in the UK, and this is something that most people are unaware of, actually it's legal for an abortion to be carried out for medical reasons at any stage in the pregnancy, all the way up until term. And so in my own hospital, abortions are carried out on quite a regular basis at 22 weeks, 24 weeks, 26 weeks, 28 weeks, 30 weeks, 32 weeks, even beyond. And on many occasions in my career, I've been called up from the baby unit where I've been struggling to save a tiny premature babies to go one floor up to the fetal medicine unit to talk to a mother who's considering having an abortion, and she's asked to speak to a pediatrician. And the baby in her womb is considerably bigger and tougher and stronger than the babies we're struggling to save one floor down. And you say to yourself, how is it possible in one hospital, in one NHS, for these contradictory things to be going on? And I think it's a very important question. How is it possible? I think part of the answer is because we live in what philosophers call a pluralistic society. That is, a society where there isn't any agreement about some fundamental issues about the value of life and about many of these difficult ethical issues. And so the Dear Auntie NHS tries to cope with all these conflicting and contradictory attitudes, and you sometimes end up then with these very strange things going on. But I want to say, we're going to be talking about some very complex and painful issues about abortion, about infertility, and about dementia and disability and dying and euthanasia and suicide. So these are very, very challenging and difficult questions. I've come to the conclusion that pretty well every medical ethical issue starts with human pain. It starts with people who struggle and suffer and agonize. And we need, first of all, as Christian people, to enter into the pain. I sometimes hear Christian people speaking about some issues like abortion or euthanasia and so on with very harsh language, with a sort of rhetoric talking about the Holocaust of the unborn, the slaughter of the innocents, this kind of language. I understand why they do it, and it's very well-meaning, but actually I worry about that kind of approach, because I think if we're going to talk about these issues, our responsibility as Christians, first of all, is to enter into the pain, to empathize with people who are suffering and agonizing. If you like, we should only talk about these issues with tears in our eyes rather than with judgment and with rhetoric in our voices. But the second important principle that we need to remember is that these are not just issues out there in society. Actually, there are issues in here, in this church. I mean, I don't know anything about virtually all of you, and yet I can guarantee there are many people sitting here who've been affected by some of the things we're going to talk about. There will be people here who've been affected by abortion. Either you've had an abortion, or your partner's had an abortion, or somebody well known to you has an abortion. The statistics suggest that 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in their lifetime in the UK. And for every woman who's had an abortion, there's a man who's involved as well. And I don't say this in any way to judge you, but simply to reflect the reality that many of us are touched by these issues, even though nobody else may know. You may well be, there are people here, there'll be many people here who are affected by infertility. The statistics again say that 1 in 6, 1 in 7 couples will have infertility and will not be able to have children without technological help. So there will be many people here, and maybe some of you young people are only going to discover about infertility later on in your life. There are many people here who will be affected by that. But we're going to talk about dementia and about terminal illness and so on. So again, there'll be many people here. You know somebody who has been affected by dementia. Dementia has touched several people in my own family. My mother developed a very severe and progressive form of dementia. So these are things which touch all of us. Because we are human beings, because we're made out of dust, because we're fragile and vulnerable, we're all affected by this. So whenever we talk about these issues, we need to remember that this is something that touches all of us. Okay, I'm going to step back a bit and think about this question of what does it mean to be human? And it's a question which many people in our society are asking. I particularly are conscious of that in the field of of science and medicine, where many people, the deep question that is being asked is, what does it mean to be human? And one of the interesting things is that people have always tried to understand what it means to be human by reference to the leading technology of the age, of the culture that we live in. So if you go back to the European Enlightenment in the 18th century, which was breaking out in France and England and Scotland in particular, what was the leading technology? Well, the leading technology was precision clocks. That was the most sophisticated kind of technology that was available. And so, lo and behold, to be a human being must be something like a precision clock. So the French philosopher Diderot said, his heart, talking about the human being, his heart is the mainspring, in his head are the bells complete with little hammers, and the soul is the tiny figure on the top listening to the music of the chimes. So it sounds amazingly quaint, doesn't it, to us now? But there's the idea, you know, the most sophisticated technology, and that must be what it means to be human. And then, so the idea that the brain was of some kind of clockwork with cogs and springs and wheels, that was very common in the Enlightenment, that the human beings were some kind of clockwork mechanism. Then what happened was that the whole age of steam and hydraulics developed. And lo and behold, to be a human being must be something to do with hydraulics. It's all about tubes and pipes and things flowing, going through different kind of connections. And in fact, a number of philosophers have pointed out that the whole Freudian view of the world, you know, if you've ever studied Freud, you'll know about his ideas of the psyche. It's all to do with libido, with this, and it's actually all about hydraulics. There's this incompressible fluid called libido, and the pressure builds up, and then it all comes bursting out in lots of different ways, and people try and repress it. This is all hydraulics. It's using the best technology of the time. So here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, and what is the leading technology? Well, it's computers. Here's a supercomputer. And lo and behold, what to be a human being is to be a computer. In fact, we're computers made out of flesh, or as Marvin Minsky put it, computers made out of meat. That's what we are. We're as human beings, we are just, again, the same process, taking the best technology of the time and trying to understand it. It's helpful to see that historical phenomenon because if you predict forward into the future, assuming that the end of the age doesn't come, then lo and behold, when this next latest technology comes along, you can guarantee that people are going to say, oh, that's what human beings are like. So how do we respond in this very confusing and complex world? Well, I was very influenced by John Stott, and one of the things he used to talk about was what he called double listening. Yes, we have to listen to the Bible. We have to listen to the Spirit, the Holy Spirit talking to us and speaking to us and informing us. But, John Stott said, we also need to listen to the world. We need to listen to what the world is saying. When he first said that, that was very controversial. A lot of people said, no, we don't listen to the world. If you listen to the world, you're going to get confused. You're going to get mislaid. We proclaim the truth to the world. But John Stott said, no, we've actually got to listen to the world in order to understand what the questions, the challenges are. And I sometimes feel that Christians are a bit like the story I heard once where the vicar is taking the Sunday school. He didn't normally take the Sunday school, but on the one particular Sunday, he was taking the Sunday school. So he decided to start off with an illustration, and he said, would any little boy or girl like to tell me what's brown or gray and runs up and down trees? And they all look at him with complete astonishment. So he tries again, brown and gray and jumps from branch to branch. They look at him. Brown and gray, jumps up and down trees, stores nuts in the winter. Complete silence. And then eventually some little boy on the front row says, please, sir, I know the answer must be Jesus, but it sounds awfully like a squirrel to me. And I like that story because I think sometimes that's what Christian people, that we feel like. You know, somebody talks about some incredible problem and we say, well, we know the answer must be Jesus, but it sounds awfully like a squirrel. And so we need to listen. We need to listen to the world, not just proclaim in a thoughtless and unthinking way a Christian truth. That's what I'm trying to do. That's what I've been trying to do in my books I've written. It's what I'm trying to do today, is to listen to the world as well as to listen to the scriptures. But we're going to start off by listening to the scriptures. Later on, we'll be listening particularly to some of the questions and challenges of the world. So here are some biblical insights on what it means to be a human being. Incidentally, I'll make the PowerPoint available so that if you like the PowerPoint slides later on, I'll make them available in the church. So three things. We're designed to reflect God's being and character. We're made out of the dust of the ground, and we're all part of a single human family. So first of all, designed to reflect God's being and character. So this very famous and well-known verse in the beginning of Genesis, God said, "Let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness." And many theologians and Bible scholars have pointed out how in the first chapter of Genesis, the way that human beings are described as the creation of human beings is quite different from all the other, the entire of the rest of creation. In the rest of creation, God says, "Let there be light. Let the earth bring forth living forth." But when it comes to human beings, first of all, he says, "Let us." And as we read this with Christian eyes, what we see is the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Together, let us make this being a special being, in our image and in our likeness. And so, in Christian thinking, human beings are not self-explanatory. We don't explain ourselves. You know, as secular scientists and philosophers and anthropologists, what they do is they study humanity and they try to understand what it means to be human by analyzing in different ways, analyzing the genetic code, analyzing how the brain works, analyzing how human beings have developed on the planet and so on, in the hope that that will explain what it means to be human. But actually, what this verse tells us is that human beings are not self-explanatory. Why? Because we derive our meaning from outside ourselves. We are derivative. We're a picture of God. We're created to be a picture of God, of the character of God himself. And here's some kind of analogy. Suppose some super intelligent alien being on the planet Zog, somewhere out in the galaxy, are receiving through their antenna a strange distorted image. And you can imagine these super intelligent alien beings analyzing every single pixel, looking at the precise frequency absorption range, looking at the strange kind of symmetry, the linear variations and so on. However much they analyze this image, they will never understand what they're looking at until they realize that it's a map. It's actually the London Underground map. In other words, those strange lines and colors in this very abstract diagram, they reflect, they're an image of something else, something completely different. These metallic objects which go trundling around in a particular planet and a particular part of the Earth. So these two things, this very abstract diagram of lines and colors, and these strange metallic objects have a hidden connection. One is a map of the other. One is an image of the other. Now, that's just an analogy, but it seems to me that's what the Almighty God chose to do. He chose to take a humble, pathetic, carbon-based life form and use that life form as a map, as an image of his own reality, of his own character, of his own being. And therefore, you'll never understand what it means to be a humble carbon-based life form like us unless you understand that we're maps. So human beings are not self-explanatory. The structure of our humanity, the values, the purposes of our lives only makes sense because we've been designed to be made in God's image. And that leads on to say that the significance and the value of each individual human life comes not from our function or from our abilities, but from the stuff of our being, from the way that God has called us into existence. It's the way we are made and the value that God has put on us that is why human beings are special. And here's another analogy, and you may have come across it before, but this is just a piece of paper. There's nothing special about this piece of paper. It's just a piece of paper. It's got some images. It's got some on it. If you were to analyze, however much you were to analyze this piece of paper, you couldn't find anything special about this piece of paper compared with this piece of paper. They're both pieces of paper. But somebody has promised that this piece of paper has special value. In fact, written on it, it says that the chairman of the Bank of England has promised that whoever turns up with this piece of paper is going to give £20. And I could screw this piece of paper up, I could tear it, it could be damaged in all kinds of bizarre ways. Its value is unchanged. It's still worth £20 because someone from outside has valued it. And that's the point about being human, that God has chosen that this particular kind of stuff, this kind of person that all of us share, God has given it this unique and precious value. And nothing can destroy that. Nothing can destroy the value of your life. Nothing can destroy the value of others that we care for. Because God has said, just like the governor of the Bank of England, that that particular kind of being is valuable, is precious. So each human life, another image is that each human life is like a masterpiece of unique and irreplaceable value, as though you've got 20 different artists all to paint a portrait of the same thing. What you'd end up with is 20 masterpieces, and they would all be different, but they would all be reflections of the one true God, the one person who was painted. And I sometimes think that maybe, you know, why are there 7 billion people on the planet? Why are there so many images? Maybe because God is so amazing and so wonderful and so extraordinary that even 7 billion portraits is not enough to reflect the reality of God. And that's a nice thought again, that each one of us has a unique insight, a unique reflection into God's character and being, and therefore you matter. However, whatever problems you struggle with, you matter because you are a unique reflection of God. And in Psalm 8, there's a verse which is normally translated that man is made a little lower than the angels. But actually, in the literal Hebrew, I understand, and I am from a Hebrew scholar, is that it can be translated as that human beings are lacking a very little of God, which is an extraordinary thing to say, isn't it? But that, again, reflects this extraordinary thing that we are reflecting God's character and being. So human beings are wonderful beings. You've never met a human being who was not wonderful. You've never, however much contaminated by sin or by disease or dementia and so on, you've never met somebody who is not wonderful. And yet, we're made out of dust. So in the next chapter, Genesis chapter 2, as you know, in the parallel creation account in Genesis chapter 2, human beings are made out of the dust of the earth. In fact, as you may know, in Hebrew, the word for Adam is derived from Adama, which is the ground. So it's actually in the very name of human is the ground. A literal translation is of human would be groundlings. That's we are. That's what we are. We're groundlings. And the same is true in English. Did you know that human, the word human, is derived from humus? Not the nice stuff you put on pita bread, but the compost heap. That's what we are made out of. It's in our very name. And so because God chose to make us out of dust, we are limited, we are fragile, we are dependent, we are vulnerable beings. And we are affected by all kinds of what philosophers call contingent events. So one of the contingent events for me is I was coming back from the States earlier this week, and I got a cold, probably on the plane. And now my voice is croaky, and I did wonder at one stage whether I was even going to be able to make it. But anyway, I'm here. But it's just an example of our frailty and vulnerability. And actually, you know, as I stand here, my life hangs by a thread. It would only take a tiny, tiny little clot in one of my coronary arteries, and I would suddenly have a cardiac arrest and fall to the floor just instantaneously. It would only take a tiny little clot in one of my carotid arteries going to my brain, and I'd have a stroke and would lose the power of speech. It would only take a tiny little change, micrograms in the neurotransmitters in my brain, and I would start hallucinating and become psychotic. So each of us, our life hangs by a thread. We are vulnerable, we are fragile. But remember, this is absolutely nothing to do with the fall. This is nothing to do with evil. This is creation, this is design. God chose to make us out of dust. He chose to make us fragile. And it's an interesting question to ask, well, why? God could have made us glorious, powerful, dynamic beings. Like the seraphim and the cherubim. You remember in Isaiah's temple, the seraphim were crying, "Hosanna, holy is the Lord." And the entire temple is shaking with the force of their voices. Well, they're created beings. God could have made us like that. And instead, he chose to make us humble, pathetic, dependent, fragile beings. And it's interesting to ask why. But you know, you came into this world utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others. In fact, the very fact that you're sitting there and looking reasonably together tells me that when you were born, somebody loved you. Somebody cared for you. Somebody fed you. Somebody wiped your bottom. Somebody kept you warm, because you would have died if there wasn't somebody who loved you. And then we go through a phase in our life when other people depend on us. And my wife and I, Celia, we've got three boys, and they're all grown up, and they've left home, and you think, thank goodness that's a go. And then the phone rings, "Dad, Dad, can you put £1,000 in my account? Dad, Dad, can I borrow the car for a month?" And you think, oh, for goodness sake. So this period of dependence where other people depend on us seems to go on for an awful long time. But, you know, most of us are going to end our lives utterly dependent on the love and care of others. And this was brought home to me in a very forceful way when my lovely mother, who was a very vivacious, active Christian lady, was struck down by a horrible kind of dementia. And in front of our eyes, she was transformed into somebody who could do nothing for herself. She was hallucinating, she was confused. She was locked in a body that was becoming contorted and she couldn't control. She was doubly incontinent. And near the end, I was visiting her. She was having 24-hour nursing care. And somebody thrust a yogurt pot and a teaspoon into my hand. And I was trying to feed her. And I was saying, "Open your mouth, open your mouth. Here it comes. Open your mouth, open your mouth." And I suddenly had this flashback. This was precisely what she used to do for me. In fact, I thought I could even remember her feeding me and her finger coming out and wiping my mouth as she was feeding me. And now, all of a sudden, the tables were turned. And I remember thinking very clearly at the time, you know, this is the way it was meant to be. I was learning more of what it meant to be a son, and she was learning more of what it means to be a mother. Because dependence is part of the story. Dependence is the way that God has made us. So dependence is not an alien, subhuman, undignified condition. It's part of the narrative of every human life. And you know, that is such an important message for our modern world, because what our modern secular world praises and cherishes above all is independence. It is autonomy, autonomos. I make my own rules. I am the boss of my life. There are many secular medical ethicists who say the principle of autonomy is the principle of all medical ethics. Everybody is free to live their own life and do their own thing. And it's a myth. It's a fantasy. None of us is ever autonomous. We're all dependent on one another. That's the way that God has made us. It's part of the creation. And I hear a lot of older people, including Christian people, who ought to know better, say something like, I just don't want to be a burden to anybody. I'm very happy to care for other people. I'm very happy to look after other people. But if I ever come a burden to somebody else, then I'm going to say to the Lord Jesus, thank you very much. I've had my life. It's time to go to heaven now. Well, it sounds very godly, but I'm sorry, it's wrong. And if you ever hear that, if you ever hear somebody say that to you, I just don't want to be a burden, or if you ever think it yourself, you must immediately say, you are wrong, you are designed to be a burden to me, and I'm designed to be a burden to you. And the life that God has given us is mutual burdensomeness. And it's true. And I think if only the Christian community could learn to live like that, the world would flock to our doors because it would be so different, so countercultural, that we're showing a better way, a way that actually comes from the way that God has made us. So we're made in God's image, we're made out of dust, and the third thing, we're made into a family. So what we see in the early chapters of Genesis is the way that the human family grows and spreads out across the world. And the interesting thing is that modern population genetics, people have been looking at the DNA of human beings around the planet, and they've gone to the rainforests of Borneo and the Amazon and the Eskimos and so on, looking at the DNA of people. And do you know what they've come to the conclusion? Every single person on the planet has a single male and a single female ancestor. Strange, that. And what that means is that if you were to turn to the left or the right as you are sitting there and look at the person next to you, you're actually looking at a distant relative. For every person in this church, we're all related. In theory, you could look in your DNA and work out that you're my third cousin, fourth removed, on my mother's side or whatever. We're all of us related. And I sometimes think this when I walk down Oxford Circus and you just see thousands of people from around the planet passing by, crowding into Oxford Circus tube station, as I was there yesterday. Every single person is a relative. And therefore, in Christian thinking, social ethics is family ethics. And that's the reason we're called to treat the strangers and the immigrants and the people who are different from us with care and with respect and with compassion. Why? Because we are family. And in any family, the strong have a duty to care for the weak. So here's another analogy. As you probably worked out, I quite like trying to find analogies. And that is that every human being is like a masterpiece. A masterpiece created by a master artist. This is a painting called The Ambassadors by the Dutch master Holbein. It's 300-400 years old. But as you can see, it has been affected by damage over the centuries and is in really quite in a bad condition. It's actually in the National Gallery in London. But the art restorers got to work. And using sophisticated technology, this is x-rays, they worked out all the brush strokes that Holbein had used and what his intentions were for the masterpiece. And then using sophisticated technology and artificial acrylics and that were designed to be like ancient Dutch oils and so on, they recreated the masterpiece. And if you were to go to the art gallery today, that's what it looks like. And that, again, is just some kind of analogy, but I think that using technology to restore the masterpiece is an appropriate thing. And there's lots of medicine which is actually like art restoration. And the question is not about the technology. The question is about what we're using it for. If we're using sophisticated technology to restore the masterpiece, to restore human beings to how they're supposed to be, then I think that's an appropriate use of technology. But interestingly, art restorers have a code of ethics, like doctors. And the code of ethics say is that you mustn't change the design. The work of the art restorer has to be guided by the artist's original intention. And just in, I think that's a helpful analogy again, that when it comes to using medical technology, the question is, are we restoring the masterpiece or are we changing the design? Are we actually in some fundamental way changing? Now, I'll come back to that as a model. And, you know, like all analogies, it's not always straightforward. Sometimes it's a sort of, there's a gray zone. Are we really restoring the masterpiece? Are we changing the design? But nonetheless, I think it's a helpful way of thinking. Okay, so we've talked about human beings made in God's image, human beings made out of dust, and human beings made into a family. But then something utterly bizarre happens. So God could have said, okay, I've made you like this. It's going to be tough. It's going to be difficult, but, you know, good luck with that. All the best, you know. Do your best as a carbon-based life form. But, you know, something utterly amazing and completely unexpected and bizarre happens. And that is God, the creator God, the God of total power and authority, decides to turn himself into a pathetic carbon-based life form made out of dust. And we're so familiar with the story of Christmas and the story of the incarnation that we've often lost how utterly scandalous it is that God should turn himself not into some kind of cherub, but actually into a real baby who vomits and squits down his mother's back. And the God of the universe makes himself utterly and totally dependent. So he can do nothing for himself. He needs to have his bottom wiped. He needs to be fed. He needs to be kept warm in that very dangerous place, which is a stable. If I was advising the Almighty on where to be born, I wouldn't recommend a stable. It's filled with tetanus spores and other dangerous places. So really, he could have chosen a bit better, and yet God makes himself utterly and totally dependent. And then on the cross, at the end of his life on earth, the God of total power and authority is stretched out on a cross, and through parched lips, he says, "I am thirsty." And he can do nothing for himself. And yet, what the Christian faith tells us is that even at his moment of total dependence, he is still upholding the universe by the word of his power. His dignity and his status as a second person of the Trinity is in no way touched by his dependence. So that's what we need to remember. You need to remember it, sisters and brothers. If at some stage, and it's very likely, you're going to end up in a hospital bed and you need to be washed and you need to be fed and you need to have your bottom wiped, your unique status and your unique dignity is in no way touched by your dependence because God has been there first. As somebody put it, God in the person of Jesus has experienced everything it means to be human. He was with us in the darkness of the womb as he will be with us in the darkness of the tomb. At every stage of life, God has been there in his own flesh. And there's a most amazing passage. I love Luke's gospel because Luke was a physician and he's got the physician's eye for those little human details. And I imagine Luke going, collecting all these eyewitness accounts. You know, he's interviewed Mary and he's interviewed Peter and he's interviewed all these different people. And he's got a whole sheaf of eyewitness accounts. And now he's trying to put them together into a gospel. And he decides to put in a bit of two pregnant women having a natter. And I think if I was writing a gospel to prove that Jesus was the Lord, I'm not sure I would put in two pregnant women having a natter. But you remember the story. Mary has just received the wonderful message from the angel. I actually think that Mary had a choice. I think, you know, God isn't some kind of cosmic rapist. I think the angel could come along and give her this news. And Mary might have said, well, you know, it's a huge honor, and I'm terribly privileged, but, you know, I'm sorry, you've got the wrong person. I'm just not up to this. In which case, the angel would have gone away and found another virgin from the house of David. And maybe we would all be celebrating Tabitha, the mother of the Lord. But in fact, Mary takes a deep breath and she says, I am the bondslave of the Lord. Let it be to me as you have said. In other words, I say yes. I give my consent. And then she runs to find her cousin Elizabeth, who's living somewhere away, to give her the amazing news. And as she goes running in, crying Elizabeth's name, just wanting to tell her this amazing news, Elizabeth is filled with the Holy Spirit. And she says to me, she says, blessed are you, Mary, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. And why am I so favored that the mother of my Lord should come to me? As soon as the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby in my womb leapt for joy. And I think Luke was so struck by that story, he said, I've got to put that in. Because from the outside, there are just two people in that room. There's Mary and Elizabeth. But actually, what Luke saw is there are four people in that room. There's Mary and there's Elizabeth, and there's the unborn John the Baptist, and there's the unborn Jesus. And John the Baptist is leaping for joy at the presence of Jesus in the way that the lame man is going to leap for joy 30 years later when Jesus walks by. But you can sort of work out vaguely, approximately, where they are. So this is a picture I often show medical students, and I say, this is what you were like, top left, when you were born. This is what you were like at 28 weeks gestation. This is what you were like at 18 weeks gestation. This is what you will look like at 6 weeks gestation. This is what you look like at 3 weeks gestation. This is what you look like at 3 days. As you go back in your own personal history, is there any point at which you can say, that's not me? And I think the answer is no, you can't. Even however far you go back, that was what you, that's exactly what you looked like. But we can also look at this picture through the eyes of that incident in Luke's gospel. And this is John the Baptist. He's about 28 weeks, and he's leaping for joy. And where is Jesus? Well, I think Jesus is about here, no more than 3 weeks. In other words, a tiny, tiny little speck, a few millimeters. And yet, Elizabeth, filled with the Holy Spirit, says, the mother of my Lord. This is my Lord. Isn't that amazing? That God turns himself into this amazingly fragile little being. So, you know, I've looked and stared at this photograph many times. And I've asked myself the question, where is God in this photograph? How do I think of it? And is God that great big hand? And I'm the sort of little hand clinging on desperately. Yeah, well, yes. That's how it often feels in my life. I'm that little hand desperately clinging on, and God is the great big hand supporting me. But you know, wonderfully and mysteriously, you can spin the photograph round, and the God of the universe chooses to make himself the little hand. He chooses to make himself dependent and vulnerable in order to teach us the dignity, the glory that can come even in total dependence. So to finish, we must defend the preciousness of every human life. Why? Yes, because we're made in God's image, but actually most of all because this is the form in which God became flesh. Because Jesus was an unborn baby, every unborn baby is precious. Because Jesus was a dying person, every dying person is precious. And therefore, we've got to see that to be like this is to be like Jesus. So our humanity is not a barrier coming between us and God. It's actually the very means by which God is revealed. I sometimes hear people saying, oh, if only I could be less human and more spiritual. If only I could be like the angels. Actually, no, that's wrong. Do you know what God's plan for you is? God's plan for you is to be more human, to be fully human, like Jesus. And for the rest of eternity and on into the future, God's plan for us is to be fully human, raised and glorified, but still human. But there's an enemy. You know, I've come to the conclusion that the evil one, the thing the evil one hates most of all, is the cross and everything that the cross represents. But you know, I suspect, you know the thing the evil one hates after the cross? It's human beings. He hates human beings because every single human being reminds him of the king. And the evil one is dedicated to destroying human life. And sometimes he does it in very obvious ways, as in, you know, terrible things going on in Yemen and Syria and Iraq and starvation and terrorism and so on. But sometimes he does it in much more subtle ways by defacing and confusing in the medical profession, through abortion, through euthanasia, through other ways in which the human image is being defaced and manipulated. And finally, dependence, fragility, vulnerability, contingency. They're all part of the creation design for human beings. And even in the new creation, we'll not lose our created dependence. So it's a strange and wonderful thing to be human, made in God's image, made out of dust, made into a family, but above all, reflecting the same stuff that Jesus was made out of. May God help us to learn more of what it means and to live in a way consistent with that. Thank you. Let's just pray.